and it went like.
Hi everybody, this is Patty Toledo. We are here with Buas Games Grindset, and today we have a really, really special guest. This is one of my favorite people ever. This is David Mulick. And David, your introduction, there are so many things that you have done during life that I will let you do the honors here. But first, thank you so much for being here. I'm super excited to talk to you.
Well, I'm excited to be here too and to talk with you. Well, to introduce myself, I'm a game designer and producer who has worked at the Walt Disney Company, Activision, 3DO Company, the Spin Master Toy Company, and a number of other smaller, both publishers and studios. And some of the games you might know me for are Heroes of Might and Magic 3, Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream, The Prisoner, and DuckTales. Those are probably my most famous games among the 60 or so that I've done throughout my career. And currently, I teach game design and production at the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, in the United States.
Who's also a dear friend of us.
That's kind of a 1 minute introduction to me.
Yeah, that was a fast one, but we're going to dig a little bit deeper and just say Art Center is a lovely partner of ours, and we always try to work really well together. They are great, so it's really cool. I wanted to go, how long is your career, David? Like, you're not that old. It can't be that long.
Oh, I wish it doesn't. In some ways, it feels very long. In some ways, it doesn't. I made my first game professionally in 1979.
Holy,
so, gosh, 46 years ago now.
Well, I wish you guys, we had camera that you guys could see David. He's a baby. He doesn't look that at all. He's like that. That's amazing.
When you keep on playing games, you stay young.
That's very true. And why did you decide to start making games? What was the drive for you to do that?
Well, I've always played games all while growing up. There wasn't much in the way of video games beyond the Magnavox Odyssey for home games and playing games in arcades. I played a lot of board games. Now, a lot of American-style board games. Monopoly, Risk, Stratego, Game of Life, Clue, you name it. We had an entire closet stacked from floor to ceiling with games while I was growing up. And I even made a couple board games on my own just for fun. And then as I got older, I got introduced to Dungeons and Dragons and would create some of my own scenarios for that. But it wasn't until college when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I took a computer science class because I was interested in robots and computers because I'm a big science fiction nerd.
Nice.
And one day while waiting to use the printer in the computer lab, I started typing out a Star Trek game.
Wow.
And while I was doing that, it suddenly hit me that being the player in a game is sort of like being the main character in a story. And that got me very excited about the idea of interactive fiction. And so I immediately went and changed my major to computer science took classes in there were no game development classes at that time. But I took classes in simulations, mm-hmm. and in artificial intelligence, which was the closest I could get to games, game programming classes. And one of my instructors took notice of what I was doing, and he offered me a job as a clerk in a computer store.
Nice.
That he and some of the other professors owned. And while I was working as a clerk in the computer store, I met the owner of a company called Eduware Services, which made both educational software and computer games. And he asked me to create some games for him to s publish. And so that's that was 1979. So that's how I got my start in the company or in the industry. And when I graduated, he hired me on full time as a game designer programmer.
I wanted to tackle on a few things that I thought it was interesting. First, that in the 70s, you were already a programming AI. I think a lot of people have a misconception that all this discussion in AI is a new thing that popped up yesterday. It has been in games forever, right? And
Right. Yeah, in fact, one of the first games I made, The Prisoner, it used artificial intelligence in the form of natural text, natural language processing, because I would have players type in what they were doing in the game, just type it in as sentences, and have the game analyzed what they meant by that. And then I also had a random map generation, what we would call procedural generation now. And so that used some primitive artificial intelligence techniques to do that.
now you said what you were you I wanted to go. You talked about The Prisoner. The Prisoner has a very interesting design choices and what you do. You actually made several games in your career that were very far from the traditional game, that some that has like really psychological and different design processes in it. And so I wanted, could you tell us, for example, on The Prisoner, for the people that are young and didn't play that yet, what were the design choices that you did there? Because it's quite interesting.
Yeah, this is a game that I made right after graduating college, and I got the idea for the game while I was in college. It's based upon the British television series starring Patrick McGoohan, which is about a somebody we think he's a spy, they never really say, who is captured and brought to a remote location, a remote village that he cannot escape from. And the entire episode is trying to get him to trying to trick him into revealing why he resigned from what we assume is a spy agency. And and it's this all the stories are about individuality versus authority, and attempts to get us to conform and to obey within a society. And as a young adult, those were very interesting topics for me, and
They
so
are
I wanted
interesting
to.
still now.
What's that?
They are still quite interesting now. It's like all
Oh
the
yeah,
mystery, yeah.
oh yeah. It seems that authority is always finding ways to control us,
True.
in different forms, different ways. So that's plus I was also very intrigued by I took a psychology class in college, and I was intrigued by an experiment in which we were told about, in which somebody was put into a room in which they were given two pieces of rope and a pair of scissors, and what they had to, the what they were told to do is find a way to tie the rope so that it stretched from one wall to the other. And as it turned out, the only way to do that was to take the scissors and not use them for cutting, but to use them to create a wedge, or so not a wedge, a clamp, to create a clamp and clamp the two pieces of rope together. So the idea of using things in ways they were not intended intrigued me as something to do in a computer game. And so I took those ideas and I created a game in which you were given at the very beginning of the game, you were given a code, and you could never reveal that code to the people you meet in the game. And the game is always trying to trick you into revealing that code. And ultimately, and what you think you're trying to do is from escape from this from this. I called it the island instead of the village, to escape from this island. All the different scenarios in the game are all based upon commentaries about different ways that society tries to get us to conform, trick us into behaving in certain ways. And probably the most infamous part of the game is where you're playing, and then if you type in something, a particular thing that indicated that you were being very uncooperative, suddenly the game appeared to crash. And they would put up the error message, error at line number, and then say what line number it was. Now, this was on an Apple II computer, and Apple II users would, if they ever see error on line number such and such, their immediate reaction would be to type in at the prompt, list line number such and such, to see where the error was. Turns out that line number was the code you were never ever supposed to reveal.
Oh, so you
And
just revealed
so
the
if you did that, yeah, if you typed in list and then your code number, you would lose the game. But it made it look like it was a true computer error rather than part of the game.
Would all the
But
players fall into it, or the were there players that actually figured the design out?
I'm sure there were players that figured the design out, because there were players who eventually won the game. The
Cool.
way you eventually won the game is you have to realize, essentially come to a realization that you're playing a game. And so if you type in at one point, you're talking to another character and saying, type in like this is a computer game, or I'm playing a game. Then it will give you an opportunity to unplug the computer, and that's how you go, and that's how you win the game. So you win the
Awesome.
game by realizing you're playing a game and making a conscious choice to stop playing the game.
This is super cool. That I like that. Also, how the fourth wall fall quite a lot, because the way you're doing the game design is also on playing with the people's immersion and the idea of how they deal with the game itself, right?
Yeah, it was very intentionally meta. So yeah, the player had to break the fourth wall in order to win the game.
Nice. But we have, if we go through all your games, I think we're gonna have like a 5 hour podcast that we can't do. David has a life. Like we could talk for 5 hours nonstop, but I wanted to go more on throughout your career, you having both designer and producer. How did the two careers overlap? Because I think for a lot of people starting in game development, nowadays, these things are very separate. When 10, 20, 30 years ago, the overlap on careers were a lot more common. So, could you tell us a little bit, how did you go from designer or producer? Was there always parallel both tasks?
Yeah, well, it started when the first few games I was a designer and programmer for them, and as the company I was working for got bigger and bigger, we brought in more programmers, and it was my boss who told me that we could make games more efficiently if I just designed the games and the other people program them. And at first I didn't like that idea, because I'm very much a loner type. And I didn't like the idea of being someone's boss, but or telling other people what to do. But actually, I found out once I started doing it, I kind of enjoyed that. So I became sort of a designer manager, working with a programmer. And as the teams got bigger and bigger and bigger, because the games got more and more complex, I got into much more of a manager role. So it was a gradual aspect to it. But in my heart, I was always a designer, so I kind of leaned into the design element of game development, probably with a little bit more enthusiasm than some of the other bits.
Yeah, the good that is there isn't even more because you started as a programmer as well. Like, well, do you still program?
No, I don't, and that's probably a big regret of mine. That's I only occasionally have ever dabbled in like scripting, But no, I don't do any programming anymore. I think the last game I programmed all by myself was in 1983. That was the last one. And then, just occasionally dabbled in scripting after that.
Makes sense. But we have to talk about my favorite game ever. I'm really sorry, this is very, very selfish, but Heroes of Might and Magic. Could you tell us a little bit about the story behind that game?
Yeah, Heroes of Might and Magic was a game series that grew out of a game created by John Van Canaham called King's Bounty. And it is a game all based upon taking set in a fantasy world in which players command armies of mythical creatures and go around and battle each other to gain territory and claim strongholds or castles owned by the other. And the game went through several iterations. I was approached by a former programmer of mine who was now working at New World Computing, which was John Van Canham's company, who said they were looking for a producer for the next Heroes of Might and Magic game, and asked me to send in his resume so he could get them interested in me. And they did. They brought me in, and I'd heard of Heroes of Might and Magic, but I'd never played it before. So they gave me a copy of Heroes of Might and Magic 2, which was their previous game, and take it home and play it. And so I did, and I fell in love with the game. It was very addicting, just filled with player choices and just so many combinations of creatures and artifacts you could pick up, things, different types of objects you can encounter while maneuvering your armies around on a map that would give you bonuses or give you power-ups or additional creatures and such. And it was just such a rich game with so many good design choices. Plus, it was fun. The music was great. The narrative was really good. And was also won a lot of awards for like game of the year. And I was playing it as I was playing it, I thought to myself, you know, there's nowhere to go but down from here. There is no way I can improve on this particular game. Except one thing I thought the artwork was not state of the art. It was a couple years behind the time. And I said, well, thing I could improve upon for a next version is the artwork. Or at least taken in a different direction. So when I went back to meet with John Van Canaham and his general manager Mark Caldwell, I told them, "Yeah, I'd be happy to lead the next version of this, but I think the artwork could be improved." And fortunately, they agreed with me because they were thinking the same thing too. So that was one of my mandates, is to bring up the quality of the artwork. And then, so the same day I was hired, they brought in a new game designer, named Greg Fulton. So he and I was both our first day, and so my the team started with myself, Greg, and then a programmer they gave us called George Ruoff, named George Ruoff. And then I was told, find a new art director to lead up your project. So I went and interviewed all the members of the. There were like 25 artists working at New World at the time, and as I talked after I talked to each one, there was one clear choice: Phelan Sykes, who not only turned out to be the best artist I thought in of the entire group, but also she was someone who was not happy with the status quo,
Nice.
and always thought they could improve. So that's the person I wanted as my art director, someone who thought everyone could do better. So that was the team I started off with, but quickly I realized we needed more programming help. So I brought in two programmers who had worked with me on a game called I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream. So I brought in John Bolton, who became the lead programmer on the project, and then David Ritchie, who became the programmer for our level editor, which turned out to be a very, very important part of the game, giving players the abilities to create their own maps for the game.
Right.
So started off as a small team, and then we started growing bigger and bigger and bigger. Really it was a case of both finding ways to improve the quality of the artwork, and Greg pointed out to me a game actually reminded me of a game that I was familiar with, of Warhammer, when he showed me that, I said, "Yes, this is a style that I want for the artwork," we took the artwork in a little bit more of a darker, more mature direction, using Warhammer as a inspiration.
How many people did you have in the team in the end?
Oh, goodness.
Was it really big? It wasn't really big at that time in comparison to the teams nowadays, like this game. Mostly AAA games nowadays are like hundreds and hundreds of people.
We had there in the design side, there was Greg plus five or six level designers.
Mm-hmm.
Then the programming side, in addition to George, John, and David, we had brought in a programmer to handle multiplayer. Jeff Leggett, another programmer, John Kraus. We brought in Gus Smedstad to do the AI programming, so about six programmers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the art side, there was Phelan. Then we had Becky Ryland, who was our assistant art director. Then about 25 artists, I think, altogether. I had an assistant producer, Chris Vanover. And then finally, the on the music side, there was my mind's blanking out on all the
worries.
Music people.
But I would say it's still about like 40, 50 people. And to say Heroes was such a big game, it still was such a big game. And for the time in comparison to the productions that we have now, I find it super interesting that we were able to make these amazing big games that were hours and hours of gameplay that people play to this day with a lot smaller teams than nowadays we do super AAA games with hundreds and hundreds of people. That was just the point. No, not trying to break your memory and remember names from there. It's all good. But you talked about I Have No Mouth, and that's a game that is really, really unique as well. Could you tell the audience a little bit about that? I know the game well. You talked to me about that before, but that's such a unique game as well.
Yeah, I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream is based upon Arthur Harlan Ellison's famous short story, and it's considered one of the best short stories in, I won't say science fiction. Harlan likes to use the word speculative fiction.
Nice. Yeah.
Of all time. And it was my favorite short story, in fact. I was a big fan of Harlan Ellison. I heard him talk at science fiction conventions. Heard him talk on talk shows. He was somebody who was always very outrageous and was a iconoclast. He really liked destroying people's perceptions of things and being very, he was a provocateur.
Those are good. Yeah.
It was always fun to listen to. I was attending a game developers conference one year, and they had Harlan there as a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, he what he was talking about was that he was developing with a company called Cyber Dreams, a game based upon I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream. And he was working with a game designer by the name of David, also another David. Boy, David's last name also escapes me. I should know this.
It's all
But
good.
anyway, so it was another David who was working for David Sears. And so I went and attended the talk, and as I was listening to it, I was actually getting very jealous of David Sears, because I thought I should be the one working on this game. It's my favorite short story. Having worked on The Prisoner, I thought, I had the right background for doing it. Well, as it turned out, about 6 months later, I get a call from Cyber Dreams saying that they were looking for a producer for I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream, and that David Sears had left the project, and they
It
needed
was
someone to head
supposed to
it
be
up.
yours. It was supposed to be yours.
I
That's it. Yeah.
yeah. And the funny thing is they called me rather than me calling them, kind of out of the blue. The company I was working for was the owners had decided to go their separate ways and close down the company. So it turns out I was in need of a job anyway. So I became the joined Cyber Dreams, became the producer of the project. It was originally planned to be a project developed by Cyber Dreams' internal team of designers and programmers, that company too was undergoing a transition. They decided to lay off their team and do all their development with outside independent studios. So yeah, that's the time I joined the company, and so I was given the design such as it was. This design was only about half written, and I needed to find a new development team to work on the project. And so I got a company called Dreamers Guild, who I knew some of the people that worked at the company, and they had developed a game called Fairy Tale Adventure that had a game engine that I thought would be appropriate to use for I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream. And then I started working on the game. Because I thought I would be the best designer for this game, I took it upon myself to complete the design for it. And then I met Harlan for the first time. I'd actually been working on the game for several weeks before I had my first meeting with Harlan. And you know what they say, be careful when you meet your heroes.
Very
Uh,
true. You
so I went over to his house, which was not too far away from Cyber Dreams headquarters. And it looked it on one hand it was kind of an unassuming house in a middle class neighborhood of Los Angeles, but on the other hand, there were gargoyles all around the edges of the roof, stone gargoyles
Proper ones, like big ones.
protected by razor wire. So it looked like I was entering this medieval fortress in a way. And so I knocked on the door, and the door opens, and there behind is my hero, Harlan Ellison. And he immediately says to me, "Oh, great, another Cyber Dreams idiot. All right, come on in. Seems like we're always getting a revolving door of people from Cyber Dreams here." So he was immediately
Not a nice
just hurling
guy. Yeah.
insults at me. And I said, "Well, I want to show you what we've done so far." And so he said, "All right, set it up on the table. You can plug it in and in the outlet." So I go and I put my computer down on the table and on the kitchen table, and I'm looking around and I could not find an outlet. So Harlan started grumbling about how stupid I was. Turned out the outlet was not, it was one that was built into the top of a counter facing upwards, and a plant was sitting on top of it. So I had to actually find the outlet by lifting up a plant and discovering it. Uh,
Instead of calling
so
you an idiot, he could have just shown that.
he could have, well, I think it was a test, maybe an intelligence test to find it. Well, I found it. Anyway, I plugged in the computer, started it up, and started showing him some of the work we'd done on it. And then I also talked about my work on The Prisoner and my interest in interactive literature, and that I would, in developing in adapting Avonmouth, I would treat his work with the same respect that I treated the television show The Prisoner, that I want to take the literary value of it and put it and frame it in such a way that it worked upon the medium of video games. Anyway, the more I talk, kind of the scowl on his face just started to disappear, and he started nodding, and I realized I saw that I was kind of drawing him over to my side, and I realized that his cantankerousness was really just his way of trying to find, he was trying to protect his interests.
Yeah,
And
understandably.
his, yeah, he wanted to protect his artistry, make sure it wasn't represented. And once he realized that I would attempt to represent him well, and create a create an adaptation that he would be proud of, we became a, I was about to say friends, but that would be too much for me to say. I would say we formed a really great working relationship with each other. So from then on, it was a pleasure working with him. And I remember the first time I brought him over some of the dialogue that I had written for some of the one of the scenarios in the game. And so I went over to his house. So I brought him a conversation that I had written between the player and another character. And he went and looked at the sheets, and he's looking at him and goes, "Who wrote this shit?" And I said, "I did." And then he immediately got very embarrassed.
Because
And he
he
said,
wasn't
oh,
trying
I'm
to be
sorry.
rude, no?
He said, "I'm sorry, I didn't realize." And he goes, No, Harlan, that's okay. You're one of the greatest living authors. Compared to you, my work is shit. So you know what? Make it better." So I mean, he went, took the papers, went off into his office while he sat down at the kitchen table. And a half hour later, he came up with, and it was improved. It was better. So that's what I used. I wish he could have done that with all of the writing in the game. I'd say that of the writing, the final, I guess, script for the game, it was about, I'd say it was about 30% David Sears, 20% Harlan, and 50% my own. And I like to think that I did a good enough job that it wasn't too glaring what was Harlan's and what wasn't.
And I find it in that a lot of the games that you worked on, and I know we're getting to the end, but I know the time is up, but and a lot of the games that you worked on became kind of cult-like following. Like, do you have real fans from the games that have been going around for a very long time that you have had to work with? How was with you working with players that were so dedicated and so in love with the games that you were created? And I also know that you were ca a character in some of the games as well, so that's also interesting.
Oh yeah, well, you're referring to as Sir Mullock. That
Yes.
was a yeah. While we were working on one of the expansions for Heroes of Might and Magic 3, I left for vacation, and then when I came back, one of my Greg Fulton came up to me and said, "We put a new hero into the game and want your approval on it." And so he brought me over the computer, and there was Sir Mullock, which was an image of me that actually I had done for a for our Might and Magic role playing game. There was there was a scene in that game where there was a group of townspeople who would judge you on how you did. And so for that game, they dressed me up in a medieval costume, and I did a thumbs up or a thumbs down for the player. Well, they took that image of me in the medieval costume and turned that into a hero of Heroes of Might and Magic.
So cool.
And they had a description of the hero of Sir Mullock that poked fun at me. So I looked at that and I laughed. And I said, "All right, you can put it into the game." So I became a character within Heroes of Might and Magic. But yeah, I didn't realize, I really didn't appreciate, I appreciate fan falling for my games until about 6 years ago, when a couple of some people from Finland were coming to the United, coming to Los Angeles on a, I think on a vacation trip, and they wanted to interview me for a podcast of their own, and so I agreed with to meet with them when they came out here, and they brought a picture of me that was hung up in a computer cafe
Nice.
in Finland. And that's when I first realized that I had fans. And within a couple of years, I realized that there was a big fan following for my games, especially Heroes of Might and Magic 3, in Europe, even more so in Eastern Europe. I started to be invited to conferences in Europe to talk about me making my games, and I ran into fans who wanted to have me sign autographs and take selfies with me, and I started to realize how big an impact my games, the games I worked on, had on people's lives. People tell me that I'm playing Heroes of Might and Magic 3. It represented their childhood,
Nice.
that they spend their childhood playing the game and help them through tough times. And eventually, some people recently told me that some Ukrainians told me that Heroes of Might and Magic 3 helped them get through some of the turmoil of the war that they're going through. So that was very humbling to hear that.
I think that's the dream of all game developers to be able to do something that is going to have a lasting impact on people. So that's amazing. And I know we're out of time, so I wanted to ask you one last question. We here at Buzz, we're creating new producers and designers every year. What advice would you give it to them in terms, what should they well any advice? What should is there anything special you think they should learn more than everything? Is there any mindset? Any advice? I think they when they start this career is equally super exciting and scary at the same time. It's so much freedom and opportunities at the same time. So from someone that has been doing that for a very long time, what advice would you give it to them?
Well, working on making video games, we're essentially working on, it requires you to work on a computer, which can be kind of an isolating experience. But as you mentioned earlier, Patty, now games are made by big teams, so we're creating games is essentially a team sport now.
True.
It's you're working with other people that have different disciplines, different talents from you. So being able to work on a team and being able to communicate well with other people, in fact, other people that may think and talk in a differently from you, may have different concerns. If you need to be able to talk with designers and artists and musicians and programmers. And you need to, when you're developing a game, explain not only what matters to you in terms of your own tasks and your own focus, but you also have to be aware of what matters to them. Because everyone needs to be collaborating together and helping supporting each other.
Very
Because
true.
it's all about supporting the vision for the game. Somebody holds the vision for the game, maybe the lead designer, maybe the producer. Could be a creative director. There's somebody on the team that holds that vision, we all have to work together toward that vision. So it's a matter of working well with other people, and ultimately remembering that The person you're trying to serve, the person you're trying to make happy is the player.
True.
Creating a game is all about creating a fun experience for the player. So that's what our focus is always should be on, from the beginning of game development to the end. Who is our player? What's gonna make them engaged in our game? And what do we do in terms of our game mechanics, in terms of our features, in terms of the art and audio? How do we go about creating the type of experience that they are going to find fun in this particular game? So it's being player focused. So being able to work well on a team and being player focused.
Those are amazing advices. Very good. Thank you, David. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. We could do the whole podcast series only with you. We didn't even scratch the surface on all the stuff that you have done in life. But thank you so much for coming.
Oh, my
here.
Pleasure. Well, we're going to have to do this again sometime.
Oh, yeah, many times. And also, hopefully, you come to the Netherlands and I show you around in the university as well. But
I would love to do that one day.
Thank you very much. And guys, I see you next week. Thank you.
And then it went like...